Hi, it's Rob Herman, and welcome to the Super Performers Podcast, powered by 4100 FS. As we worked on developing this podcast, our overriding goal was to create a compelling platform for accessible insights on work and life from successful, driven, and highly accomplished leaders. Leaders with unique experiences across a wide variety of fields, including business, medicine, law, sports, entertainment, education, and philanthropy, among others. In my head, I started to work through a fascinating group I wanted as guests, and I got pretty excited about it. I've gotten to know these people through my own varied experiences early in my career on Capitol Hill, later working on Wall Street and as an investment manager, being an entrepreneur, and now leading a unique and thriving company called 4100 FS, while also focusing on community engagement. I think you'll really enjoy hearing the stories of these guests, learning about their respective paths, finding out what motivates them, and how they define success. Glad to have you with us on the Super Performers Podcast. And without further ado, on to our guest today. Today, our guest on the Super Performers Podcast is Michael Goldberg. Michael Goldberg is the inaugural executive director of the Veal Institute for Entrepreneurship at Case Western Reserve University. He's also a professor of design and innovation at the Weatherhead School of Management, where he teaches courses on entrepreneurship and early stage finance. Michael created a massive open online course, also known as a MOOC, called Beyond Silicon Valley, Growing Entrepreneurship in Transitioning Economies, which has attracted over 175,000 students from 190 countries with subtitles in 16 languages. He's also the author of the book Beyond Silicon Valley, How One Online Course Helped Support Global Entrepreneurs. Previously, Michael co-founded the Bridge Investment Fund, a venture capital fund focused on investing in Israeli medical device companies, and he was the director of international business development for America Online, responsible for structuring and negotiating international partnerships in Asia. Michael also previously worked for Microsoft and the international management group, IMG. Michael has deep experience teaching entrepreneurship in international markets and was awarded multiple Fulbright fellowships. Michael's also been a visiting professor teaching courses on entrepreneurial management and finance, as he conducted seminars on behalf of the U.S. State Department on Entrepreneurship in 31 countries. Michael Goldberg, welcome to the Super Performers Podcast. It's great to have you on. We've been talking about this for a while, so excited to dig in with you.
Great to be here. I've already been a guest on Gabe Herman's All-Star Sports, which, for those of you who don't know, is Rob's son. So, you know, that was the professional highlight, and this might be number two.
That's exactly right. Gabe and Michael, the best episodes. I used to join Gabe, but then he saw that joining with Michael was a much more effective way to go. So I was replaced on his YouTube channel dealing with sports, primarily Cleveland related sports. But that's a different conversation. And let's just dig in. Usually speaking of Gabriel Herman, my son, he told me you always go in chronological order for these podcast episodes. Why don't you mix it up? And I think you're the perfect person to start in a little bit different place, which is your travel exploits, and both professionally and personally, as long as I've known you, which has been decades, you traveled also personally. You're interested, you're a global citizen. But it was interesting, and I mentioned some of this in the bio. You look at your Fulbright fellowships in Vietnam, Namibia, Spain, and the Canary Islands, Portugal, Cambodia, visiting professor in Turkey and Greece, and you conducted seminars on behalf of the U.S. Department of State on a lot of countries. I could bookend it with the A's down to the Z's, Argentina, Austria, and then Zambia, Zimbabwe, but there's a lot of countries in between too. So tell me a little bit, because I want to dig into the personal side of your interest in travel, but also the professional side of it, which is considerable with the Fulbrights, among other things. And also, from a personal perspective, you brought your kids and Stacy, your fantastic wife, on these trips too. Tell me a little bit about the origins of where all this travel interest started from.
At a young age, my own parents took us on a couple trips, and then actually they were supportive if I wanted to do more. in college, actually, every summer, I went and did something different during my summers. I worked at a refugee camp, actually, for Russian Jewish immigrants, a topic close to your heart, Rob, that were coming out of the former Soviet Union in 1989. And the summer of 1990, I actually went to the then Czechoslovakia right after the Velvet Revolution. And interestingly, I just took some students back there about a month ago. And was an English teacher, and then went to South Africa for the first time on a Princeton, as part of a course, but got some funding to do that. And then, so that, those experiences gave me a taste. And then right after I graduated from Princeton, I spent 3 years living in South Africa and working first in a rural Black school, part of a program called World Teach. And then as South Africa moved towards their first democratic elections, had a chance to work for a, U.S. NGO funded by the U.S. Agency for International Development called National Democratic Institute. So I spent a total of 3 years there. So in some ways, those university experiences, sort of travel with my family, and then sort of the university experiences, and then 3 years after college in South Africa kind of set the stage for a lot of travel that I did afterwards.
Yeah. And by the way, your parents are super people. David and Brenda, love your family. And as a matter of fact, David, your dad introduced me to my business partner, Sally Grease. So I owe your family a lot in terms of the positive impact it's had on me. So I'm not surprised to hear that about the family roots. It is interesting, though, because for context, you have a family that has deep Cleveland, Ohio roots. Your family had a bank for multiple generations and active in philanthropy, active in community. But talking about your work in South Africa post-Princeton, it doesn't strike me that you, you know, kind of, and maybe at one point you considered it, that you weren't looking to go the traditional route. You weren't interested right after college or even in the years ahead, looking to come back to Cleveland and work in the family business as successful, as significant as that was. You were looking to go a different route. Was that always in your mind kind of growing up? Did it kind of surface in college? Did you consider coming back to Cleveland right after college? What was the thought process there? Because as you said, you went to South Africa, you did some pretty meaningful things right off the bat, but it was a pretty different track perhaps than others.
Yeah, I mean, I credit my parents. Shout out as well to David and Brenda. I'm sure yep. They'll be listening to this.
As they should.
As they should, as parents do. I mean, they were supportive. I mean, when even staying, I was supposed to go to South Africa for a year and ended up staying three, they were very supportive. And when people were like, how could you let him stay there for so long? And there was a bunch of things happening in the country, including some violence. And to my parents' credit, they sort of let me, it's like, it's fine. And, you know, they kind of trusted my judgment. Yeah, I mean, I always sort of had this interest in doing things outside the U.S. Eventually I moved back to Cleveland, but I didn't have a ton of interest in coming back right afterwards and wanted to see a bunch of the places. And in fact, I wasn't sure that I necessarily wanted to come back here, and a number of factors, including my wife, who got from Chattanooga, Tennessee, was interested in kind of being closer to family as we had our first two kids in DC. So, yeah, I mean, as a parent now, as you are, Rob, like, and my kids, actually, my first one's graduated from college in a month, like, we've talked about, she's going to go overseas for her first job, and she's doing a Princeton Latin America program in the Dominican Republic, teaching at a rural school there. And I'm like, yeah, you know, it's interesting at times when your own kids, I mean, oftentimes they'll do the exact opposite of what their parents do, but at least in this case, my oldest one is doing a very similar path to what I'm doing. And I said, hey, who knows what you do afterwards? I didn't go to South Africa originally with the vision that I would stay there for 3 years or that what it would lead to. I just think to some degree I've collected many experiences along the way. Many of them have been overseas, and then just sort of seen where that will lead to.
Yeah, you know, with my wife Valerie and I, we use your family, you and Stacy and your three kids as an example of instilling this love of travel and being a global citizen, having that perspective. I know also your son You know, Anna, Kate, and Matt, your three kids all have a love of travel and have all been in many countries alongside you and Stacy. But Matt was also, he went, finished up his last couple of years of high school overseas. I know all three of your kids have that perspective, as does Stacy. But it is interesting. We met in DC through mutual friends. And at that point, I think that was probably around the time you were just coming back from South Africa, or maybe in between. Mm-hmm. But you kind of settled in DC after that. You worked, I think, for AOL at that point, which at the time was a different kind of company. Prior to the Time Warner merger, people thought a lot of AOL, and you did some really, on that theme of international work, you did some international business development, working a lot in Asia. What was that experience like, especially, I mean, probably a little bit of culture shock coming back to the U.S. after being in South Africa for 3 years. What was that experience like? And again, going into the for-profit world for the first time, really, post that experience in South Africa. Pretty different context and framework, I would imagine.
Yeah, I mean, it was interesting. And I remember I did stay on your couch, I think, when I applied to MBA programs from South Africa, including the Kellogg School of Management. And so I visited when I was accepted there. Actually, I remember being at Kellogg. I don't know if I even told you the story. I was like an admitted student's day. And there was a whole room of people, and they're like, and we have such a diverse group of people that we've admitted. We've got, I don't know, somebody that started this business and somebody that did this. And then they're like, and somebody that ran voter education programs for South Africa's first democratic election, and like some random person, they're like, isn't that you? I'm like, oh yeah. So I was the diversity.
I think there was only one of those people in the room.
It's like, I didn't think there were two. So. Yeah, I mean, I remember when I called my parents, actually my dad in particular, as everything hinges back to our families. And I was like, hey, I have two pieces of good news for you. Like, one is I'm going to leave South Africa there kind of after 3 years. And I was like, and secondly, I'm applying to MBA programs. So I had, as you referenced, I hadn't done anything in the private sector. I initially actually thought that I wanted to go to like a public policy school or an international affairs school. And then I learned from a colleague at NDI, National Democratic Institute, you could do these three-year joint programs. So I was accepted to a couple of business schools and a couple of public policy schools. And ultimately, I decided to do Wharton's MBA and a master's in international affairs at Johns Hopkins, their School of Advanced International Studies, without really any particular view towards what I would do with the degree when I got back. Part of it was just like, now that I work in higher ed and at a business school, like, you know, sometimes people go to an MBA program because they know exactly what they want to do. And other times you're just like transitioning from one thing to the next unknown thing. So that was very much me. So I showed back up in the US. Went to Philly, I was a little bit of a reverse culture shock. I also like had never taken accounting or finance or any of those classes. So I was like both a little bit re-emerging into kind of U.S. life, and then also like trying to balance my key accounts and accounting and trying to figure out how to use Excel. And I probably wasn't like in the world of working on teams. Actually, I still keep in touch with a few of my, at Wharton, we call them learning teams. I kind of felt bad for them that they got me because I was not.
You're a hard worker.
A couple areas I had some unique talents in, but not in modeling or a few. So we divided and conquered around some of the work. And let's just say I wasn't leading the charge in any of our modeling exercises. So,
yeah. By the way, two reactions to your business school experience, because it's not dissimilar from mine. Yep. First of all, I remember the first week in business school having lunch with a bunch of people, and one of the guys at the table said, to your point about people saying probably in their applications they know exactly what they want to do, but nobody really having an idea. And he said, well, how many of you actually know what you want to do with this business degree? It was like 30 people and nobody's hand went up. So, you know, that's part of the discovery process. And on the modeling side, I do remember in the days when you could lose work really easily, learning Excel as I went for a summer internship to do complex modeling, and then at like 2 a.m. losing my work, being like, I don't know if I can ever recreate it again. So what you're saying resonates, but sorry, go ahead with the story about the reentry.
I know you well. I know you also had a non-traditional journey into the world of high finance. So I showed up at business school, and I think what was interesting, and you made reference to America Online, which perhaps some of your viewers or listeners have heard of that company. I mean, it's interesting now teaching where I'm like, I worked at a company called America Online, AOL. How many of you have heard of it? And it's like a smattering of hands. And like, we were once the largest, what was known as internet service provider. I mean, we many people remembered AOL for like flooding their mail with CDs to install the software. And it was actually a pretty interesting time because I didn't know what I wanted to do post-business school, as we were sort of referencing. But I liked this idea of unstructured, kind of fast-growing companies. It's funny, I did my job search a little bit and like, oh, I want to work at what I was called, like, cool companies. Which even some of my friends at Wharton were like, what does that even mean? Although at the time, I don't know if anybody would call AOL cool, but so.
It was cooler then than it is now.
Yeah, it's probably, yes. I don't know if it was ever cool, which actually that was part of our appeal. It was like for, you know, helping essentially like Steve Case's mom or people like our parents sort of get online for the first time. And this was over phone line, so it was incredibly slow. We couldn't be doing fancy podcasts like this over a phone line.
That's strange.
So I joined, I did my summers, I did one at IMG, the International Manager Group, in the kind of a interactive media group. And then I worked at Microsoft out in Seattle for a summer. And then got the job at AOL. And it was awesome. Like I was working on international business development to help bring us into new markets. Because I like traveling and like kind of figuring out new markets, I did a lot of work in China it's kind of interesting given a lot of the discussion in the news around China and that time when they entered the WTO, which actually brought a lot of different, we can debate as people are now, kind of what that meant as we sort of lowered barriers to engage with China in business and in trade. But like, we were doing a lot of activity to try to enter that market. And I spent a lot of time there with some of the early Chinese internet pioneers like Jack Ma from Alibaba and a couple of the other companies. So it's a pretty interesting time to be over there. So I spent about 5 years at AOL. I never moved. Actually, Stacy and I were supposed to move right before we had after we got married and had our first kids to China, and it ended up falling through. I ended up just kind of traveling back and forth from DC to the region. But yeah, it was interesting wearing a private sector hat for AOL and sort of engaging in these international markets. So I really enjoyed that.
Because I know the backstory, you talked about Stacy, who seemed game to move to China, which, you know, is a testament to her love of travel as well and new adventures. But I remember, and I haven't talked to you guys about this in a long time, but I remember vaguely that you guys met initially on family vacation. And incidentally, I should give a shout out to the Stacy side of the family, Hyman and Susan Kaplan. Hyman is somebody who's been a great mentor and just continues to be somebody I'm close to. So I've really kind of intervened in your family in many ways, Michael. I apologize.
We'd like to get rid of you.
Yeah. I'm sorry about that. You're stuck.
That's good to have you.
So it was a train that took a couple of years, but ended up in a good place. Stacy is fantastic and got a beautiful family to show for it. You talked about Blackboard. It's funny, I haven't heard Blackboard much recently, but it was at one point the premier, you know, kind of education platform, post-secondary, even some K-12. I can't even remember the history. It's been a while since I've tracked education-related platforms. Was Blackboard acquired? Does it still exist?
They went public and then were acquired through private equity and sort of taken private. And yeah, I mean, they are still around. We actually used to use them at Case, but no longer. So I think their growth trajectory is not what they thought it would be, but fill in the high-tech, high-flying startup who that has taken some different paths along the way, and they're probably included in that.
I'd be curious to hear what their peak market cap was. I can't remember the time, but they were a high flyer.
Something with a B.
Yes, for sure. And I remember Stacy was doing some interesting work there. Okay, so now you've been at AOL. Stacy's been at Blackboard. You're living in Northern Virginia. Got a kid. I can't remember if your second daughter was born yet. So you had two kids, right? And then I remember because I was moving from New York. You were moving to DC. We were moving to Cleveland at around the same time. And what was the gravitational pull to bring you back? And I know part of it was, we can talk about the Bridge Investment Fund, but was it, hey, we've got a family now, we want to be closer to the other generations? What was the thought process there?
So yeah, the move back to Cleveland, there were a couple of different factors. One was being closer to family. The second really was professionally related through actually a family connection. Jeff Ponsky, who was the chief of surgery at University Hospital, used to be at the Cleveland Clinic, had met a company out of Israel called Symbionics that was doing simulation for minimally invasive surgery. And that led to an early stage investment, actually from a company called Early Stage Partners, that brought that company to Cleveland. And so this idea that there were interesting tech-based startups, particularly in med tech, that could come out of Israel, kind of establish a beachhead in Cleveland because of the strength of the healthcare institutions here. So we set up a new venture fund with that as the focus, sort of pre-US commercialization medical device companies. And so that brought me back to Cleveland. It also sort of coincided with some efforts in the state of Ohio and in Cleveland to support the growth of early stage startups in the region. So kind of some good things came together at once, sort of on the personal and professional side. And yeah, we decided to move the family. At that point, two kids, Matthew was born once we moved here to Cleveland.
Yeah. Sounds like a pretty fascinating learning experience, but also, as you said, a lot of things came together and it pulled you in a different direction than what your career had been up until that point. I mean, I know you were involved in smaller businesses and thinking about seeding businesses in your prior roles. But tell me about the evolution of that prior to your interesting move, which I'm eager to dig into, your move to academia and the massive open online course and what that led to. But tell me a little bit about how that experience evolved. How long did you do Bridge for?
So we started the fund in 2005. And it was my first foray in venture capital. I mean, we had worked at AOL on the acquirer side with a number of startups, actually including a company out of Israel. This will take you way back, Rob. ICQ, do you remember that company? That was a messaging company. Which is sort of one of the pioneers in instant messaging. So I'd never directly deployed capital in startups as a venture fund. And so yeah, we launched in 2005, 2006. Started looking to deploy capital. It was interesting. I mean, as you are well aware, venture as an asset class, typically you're investing alongside syndicate partners on like kind of private equity funds where you might acquire an entire company. So yeah, built a lot of relationships with other funds, both in Israel and in the US, and really enjoyed it. A bit of a non-traditional path into venture. And then to kind of link it to the teaching journey, and I was like guest lecturing a couple times in about the topic of venture capital at Case Western Reserve University. And then in 2010, a colleague asked if I'd want to adjunct a course, so basically teach many universities have what are called adjunct professors, kind of who have expertise from the outside, not necessarily training as researchers or teachers. So I taught for the first time in 2010 and really enjoyed it, and then ended up after a number of years and just doing it part-time, taking a full-time teaching position about 10 years ago here at Case Western Reserve.
Well, so it's a good segue. And I remember having lived in Cleveland at that time, watching the evolution of Bridge Investment Fund, really, really interesting. And the people you worked with did a lot of cool things. But for context, this massive open online course, which is available really to anywhere, anybody in the world, was called Beyond Silicon Valley, Growing Entrepreneurship and Transitioning Economies. And what you built, I'm going to ask you in a second if you could have foreseen this growth, has attracted close to 200,000 students. I think it's 175,000 students from 190 countries with subtitles in 16 languages. Wrote a book about it, which is a great read, Beyond Silicon Valley, How One Online Course Helps Support Global Entrepreneurs. But tell me, so you're an adjunct professor, you're starting to get your feet wet in academia, enjoying that piece. I was fortunate enough to participate in one of your classes and come in and talk to the students, which is a lot of fun. I haven't been asked back since, so I have to assume that's an indication of how
maybe,
I did.
Maybe after this podcast blows up, we'll have you back.
That's right, after it gets some viral play. But tell me about the development of this massive open online course and what it led to. So like developing the coursework around it, the idea behind it, what was the genesis of it?
So some of it links back to where we started in terms of sort of international wanderlust. I'd actually always wanted to take my, the kids were still little. I mean, they were third grade, second grade, and kindergarten. And I applied for a Fulbright to Vietnam, just sort of on a lark. Like, I wasn't even sure that adjunct professors could do that. And I was like, you can. And so I got it. And so we moved the family to Hanoi. And I was at a business school there and the National Economics University. And while I was there, I was asked by someone within the Vietnamese government. They have a national agency for technology, entrepreneurship, and commercialization. They asked me if I could do a workshop about how Vietnam might become more like Silicon Valley. And I was like, actually, you guys look more like Cleveland than Silicon Valley. Of course, they were like, what are you talking about?
Weren't sure where Cleveland was, I'm guessing.
At that point, it was sort of, so this was 2012. I think LeBron had just left. It's always like, as a Cavs fan, like your son and your mother-in-law, we often sort of gauge ourselves in the LeBron eras. So this was, I think he was in Miami. People had heard about Cleveland.
The first time he left.
So I brought, what it has happened in Cleveland and Ohio, broadly speaking, through programs like the Ohio Third Frontier Program, which is a state program started under Governor Bob Taft in about 2002. That program brought quite a bit of support in the entrepreneurship economic development sphere, including really in the Cleveland area, supporting an organization called Jumpstart, which spun out of Case Western Reserve University. It was actually started here and supported the growth of early stage startups. There was a lot of philanthropic funding. So it was this sort of three-legged stool of government, donor, and private sector funding, which, if you look at Vietnam, also had those elements. A lot of government support, philanthropy coming through more of the donor community, international donors, and then private sector. So we did a workshop there via Skype, another tech throwback. I think Skype is officially dead now, but it was like the early Zoom. And had a number of people from the Third Frontier and Jumpstart and Case Western Reserve kind of talk about how different programs are supporting the growth of entrepreneurship in Cleveland. And then we were talking about how those lessons from our experience in Cleveland might apply in Vietnam. And then when I came back to the U.S., you mentioned MOOCs, massive open online courses. Case had just signed a partnership with Coursera, which is one of the largest platforms for MOOCs. And so I had an idea about sort of turning that seminar into a MOOC, and we got funding from the Burton D. Morgan Foundation here in Northeast Ohio, and we were kind of off and running. It was kind of documentary style. It was a lot of interviews. I had a friend of mine who used to work at 60 Minutes kind of help me kind of envision what that might look like. We used a lot of B-roll and things like that. So kind of put it up on Coursera without really knowing if anybody would be interested. Like, I wasn't a well-known professor. I mean, Case, even relative to other schools on the platform, perhaps less well-known than some of the other big names. And yeah, we found, particularly in international markets, it had a big big audience. And yeah, a lot of my travel that you referenced at the beginning of the podcast has been kind of on the back of that online class, because people have watched it or participated in it in different markets. And so I've gotten a lot of invitations. The U.S. State Department has been a great partner as well, both through their Fulbright program, which is kind of their preeminent educational stage, but I've also just done a bunch of shorter programs with different embassies around the world just over time. And as you referenced, I've also taken either my whole family or one kid on some of those trips. So that's been great.
Yeah. I mean, several Fulbright fellowships, visiting professor in multiple countries, and then seminars I referenced on behalf of the State Department, too many countries to count. But I mean, it's interesting because when you think about how it caught on, as you said, it was a viral play. People were starved for content around growing entrepreneurship, especially, you mentioned, it's interesting because everybody talks about Silicon Valley, but making it work in a Midwestern city like Cleveland. Cleveland in particular has some interesting parallels, as you referenced. And not only in larger countries, but you found in even countries that had very difficult geopolitical environments or economic environments, people gravitated towards this course, which to me shows, and I think you've probably found this time and time again, but I'm curious to hear you comment on it, the appetite for entrepreneurship around the world. It doesn't matter where you are or what your situation is. Being an entrepreneur has universal appeal.
Yeah, I think, not surprisingly, whether it's more established urban centers or any number of communities, small business growth and entrepreneurial growth have been staples of economies around the world. And not surprisingly, particularly elected officials that are concerned about job growth or job retention, they're often looking to what they can do to create the next high growth company in their community. Oftentimes these are tech-based in some way, obviously in a growing way. And even our current national or sort of global discussion around markets and supporting or protecting local markets, I think it's a very interesting global moment as we as communities, whether it's a local community like Cleveland or a state like Ohio or a nation, like, how do we best support the growth of new companies? Because with those new companies comes job creation. So I think it's a really interesting moment. And I think it turned out that Cleveland, because we're not sort of shoving a San Francisco or Silicon Valley model down someone's throat. And, obviously there are people, there's a lot to learn from the Silicon Valley experience. But some of it, in markets around the world, perhaps felt less relevant than like Cleveland's struggle and experience and doing some of the same work.
Persevering, yeah. So there's a lot of, in your book, we'll put in the show notes, the link to the book as well. But your book, you gave some great case studies and examples of things you've been, you know, kind of encountered as you grew the course. Tell me, you know, some of the more interesting markets, maybe that you were surprised that people were following you and taking the course in the context of what you might expect to see. Not that surprising to see somebody from Western Europe, perhaps, but tell me a little bit, some examples of, you know, interesting geographies that have participated in this course and their stories.
So it's been sort of fascinating to see where students have taken the class from. And it's kind of, as you allude to, like where they found value. So we had an Iranian student named Mehdi Sajapour, who was an entrepreneur in Tehran. And, you know, interestingly, saw a lot of parallels between some of the work they were trying to do to support startups in Iran and Cleveland. And I did a seminar for Mehdi and some of his colleagues at a university there, leading research university. And he translated the subtitles into Farsi. I think we were one of the first MOOCs on Coursera to have subtitles in Farsi. And, you know, I think I got a lot of gratification of just that person-to-person connection. I mean, it doesn't matter what country we're from or what religion we are, like just two people kind of coming together around a topic where we're sharing ideas. I got invited to visit Kosovo, which is a place I didn't know much about outside of kind of having it gone through a terrible conflict. And, you know, unfortunately for me, it turns out that I scheduled it during the Cavs championship in 2016. So I got to watch the Cavs parade that Stacy and Matthew attended in Cleveland. I was with Kate Goldberg watching it on my iPad in Jakova, Kosovo, but I had a wonderful time there. So it was interesting, like seeing what lessons they could draw. And then, yeah, I've done a lot in a number of parts of Africa. And it's been quite gratifying to see, just in this very small way, like some of the lessons that we learned have been useful to other countries. I just did something. Actually, Stacy came with me a couple years ago in Madagascar. It's a very interesting place with a lot of challenges. And again, gratified to see that there was some value that people could take away from the work that we've done.
Yeah, I mean, the impact, and I would tell anybody listening that's interested in this arena, even if you're not interested in being an entrepreneur, the coursework is fascinating and I think really productive. But it's interesting, as time goes on, the number of people take the course, you must continuously hear about the impact, the positive impact of the course and what you're doing. And I imagine as time goes on, given your travels, and you mentioned a lot of the travel emanated from the course, that you continuously meet new people in person that have taken the course in different geographies and hear, you know, kind of more about what they've done with it. But I'm waiting for part two of the book to come out with some new case study. But I mean, is that something that you, when you think about the future and what you want to do, is it continuing to kind of meet those people, travel, and spread the word about global entrepreneurship, which, you know, has a positive byproduct, not just on a business level, but more broadly on a societal level? What is the next step? Are you going to continue to do that and meet with the people that take the course?
Yeah, I mean, we do it in different ways. Like I said, this came before recording this podcast. I was teaching kind of a seminar version of the Beyond Silicon Valley course. And we pick one geography to do kind of a deep dive on. And we're this semester focusing on Brno in the Czech Republic, which is the second largest city in the Czech Republic, university town. And over spring break, I took a group of our students, both MBA students and undergraduate students, to Brno. And very interesting. We had hosted a Fulbright scholar from Brno here at Case. And it's just been a great, it doesn't really matter which place we pick. We did something on a post-conflict Syria. We've done Colombia. We've done Brazil. So I've kind of intentionally chosen different places where we can do a deep dive. So I'm using kind of the curricular kind of course vehicle here at Case, and then still doing a bunch of travel. I'll be going and visiting our middle daughter in Uruguay in June, and I'll do something for the U.S. Embassy there while I'm in town. So yeah, I continue to do it. And again, just have been really gratified that there's just continued interest in a dialogue. And again, not presuming that we know we're experts on this, but just sort of we can share some things that have worked or that haven't worked and learn from their experience. And then, so that's been, I continue to look forward to doing more of that.
It's great. And it's a good segue to talking about your career in academia, because you're the inaugural executive director of the Beal Institute for Entrepreneurship at Case Western Reserve's Weatherhead School of Management. And you're also now a professor at Weatherhead School, teaching courses on entrepreneurship and early stage finance. As the son of an academic, knowing that academic world well, and my dad's many decades of teaching, it's interesting because I don't think it's what you would have anticipated, but you're really doing some cool things with that Beal Institute. I mean, the coursework that you're teaching and the research you're doing is compelling as well. But talk a little bit about the Institute for Entrepreneurship and the kinds of programs that exist there, because I think it is innovative and you're leading that.
Oh, great. Sure. Thanks. Many universities, including your alma mater at the University of Michigan, or even your neighbor down at your University of Cincinnati, have different centers and institutes to support entrepreneurship. I mean, I would say there's been a tremendous rise, certainly since the time you and I were in college, when there weren't a lot of these centers or institutes, to now many universities, often with the support of donors that have succeeded in their careers through entrepreneurship. So in the case of Case Western Reserve, Tinkham Veal, who's an alum and an entrepreneur, endowed through their foundation the creation of the Veal Institute. And it's been a lot of fun. Actually, we created a fellowship for undergraduate students, sort of based on something I had seen at University of Michigan through their Engineering School Center for Entrepreneurship, where we take students out to San Francisco in the fall over our fall break. Then we do an international trip. Actually, we just took that group to Brno, Czech Republic, as I was referring to a few minutes ago. We run pitch competitions. We do some work to help students understand entrepreneurship with a venture capitalist hat. So we have a fund that we manage where we've made 15 investments, where students lead the due diligence process. We have a faculty fellowship working with really talented faculty that have ideas they want to commercialize. So yeah, it's been a lot of fun. So I'm still teaching and still a full professor here at Weatherhead School of Management, but spending a lot of time having fun with our Entrepreneurship Institute and sort of seeing ways that we can support our students, alumni, faculty, and staff here at the university.
Yeah, I feel like you're leading the charge. I mean, starting from the time that you began teaching the massive open online course, the MOOC, and to today, and the way it's evolved with the Beal Institute for Entrepreneurship and being a professor. But it strikes me, not only is Case and you specifically kind of a leader and thinking about entrepreneurship, but it strikes me, because I remember having conversations probably a decade or so ago about entrepreneurship and where academia was. It strikes me that there's been a sea change in the construct at the post-secondary level, higher institute of education, of how they view entrepreneurship. Is that fair? Has the paradigm shifted quite a bit?
Well, I think what's also happened, in addition to activity in higher ed, is that, and I don't know if your own kids have done any entrepreneurship things in high school or middle school, I think this, the value of, as an educational experience, putting students through the paces of coming up with an idea and doing what we often call customer discovery, where it's like, does anybody want the product or service that you're thinking about offering? So I think there's value in that activity, and that now we're seeing it more and more in high school. So students are showing up at places like Case Western Reserve, oftentimes like that they've done something. In this case, some of them have done more your traditional, you know, summer mowing lawns or putting down mulch or doing something. But some of them like may come with an app, or they've done marketing, or they have a YouTube channel or an Amazon Marketplace. I mean, there's some interesting ways that young people are coming to campus. Maybe some of it is their own attempt to get into good schools like Case or University of Michigan. But yeah, so but you're getting people here that are kind of wired. And so some are interested. And then, you know, I think whether it's, you know, Ross at Michigan or University of Cincinnati or here, like there's just a growing, even at the undergraduate level, there are opportunities to get involved in taking credit-bearing courses. So there's extracurricular, co-curricular pitch competitions and things, and then there's actual getting credit for courses. So there's just a growth in that interest level, broadly speaking. And yeah, it's fun to be part of it. I mean, it's not the only way. You know, you and I didn't study it as undergrads, and we sort of ended up in business. So there's other ways to navigate it. But some people are laser focused on getting into careers in business and want to have their undergraduate educational and extracurricular experience towards shaping that.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting because I've always viewed you as an entrepreneurial bridge as a good example of that. A lot of other things you've done in your career, but even what you've done at Case in itself is entrepreneurial in a different way. And it's really neat to see how that's evolved. And I'm eager to see what happens next as you think about that broader idea of entrepreneurship, how to teach it, how to communicate it effectively, and certainly done globally. I also noticed that you are a pretty frequent kind of person who appears in the media. And I imagine a lot of that's driven by the kind of what you've done with entrepreneurship. But I think, you know, I see your name online and media, audio, you know, kind of whether it's television or with MSNBC's Your Business. Is that something that you'll continue to do to spread the word about your, you know, kind of your teaching and your focus of study? Is it something that you enjoy doing, or have you had enough of it? Because I think spreading the word is a good thing, but I know it can be exhausting.
It's interesting being a faculty member, and oftentimes media needs someone who has a title professor to comment on something. So I'm a bit of a generalist on some of these topics, but I try. I mean, I think it's good for the university. I think it's good for the work we're doing at our Entrepreneurship Institute to have our leaders kind of out there sharing perspectives. I mean, my wife often has, I'll say I comment on something. She's like, what do you know about that? And I'm like, well, maybe not a lot, but I do try to kind of do some quick research on topics. So yeah, I mean, I enjoy doing it, and I try to give them short. If it's local news, I try to make it short and snippable so that they can use it. So I've enjoyed it.
It's good. It's good for the university. It's, you know, that your areas of expertise and what you do. So your day job is important enough to get your name out there. So I'm glad you do it. And I always enjoy seeing it. And you pull it off pretty well, even on disparate topics. It works nicely. All right, Michael. Well, so we have to end on a Cleveland sports note, because that's you know, who you are. You're a diehard Cleveland sports fan. So I've got two questions for you. One, who is the Browns starting quarterback going to be next season? And number two, what's your forecast for the Cavs in terms of their playoff run?
It was such a nice conversation, and you had to ask about the Browns quarterback situation. I mean,
that's fraught.
I would say no comment on that mess of a quarterback situation. It's been hard for those of us that had to cheer for the Browns. So we will see. I'm glad they kept the coach in the front office, which I think are good. So we will see. And then, Cavs have been quite exciting this year. And not sure when this podcast will drop, but I'm crossing my fingers that it's a good long run. And it's really a good, likable team. And Coach Kenny Atkinson is a new Cleveland Heights resident. And
he's your next-door neighbor, the coach of the Cavs.
My next-door neighbor. I won't mention on the podcast where I actually live. So. they're a super family, and it's been fun watching his success, and hope they can do more of it over the upcoming weeks.
I'll be happy if they beat the Celtics. That's job one. Yeah. On a more serious note, Michael, it's been an incredible career you've had, and the way it's evolved, it's been a lot of fun to watch. And again, I want to circle back, mention the show notes, or about a link to the massive open online course and the book, but the way it's taken off and impacted lives, it's something to be really proud of. So thank you for all you're doing and all the work Pace is doing on the entrepreneurship side. Look forward to seeing you, Stacy, and your family sometime soon. But thank you for being on the Super Performers podcast, and look forward now separately. I learned a few things about you, even though I've known you for a long time. So look forward to following up with you. But I'm sure our audience will enjoy it a great deal, and we'll talk to you soon.
Great. Thanks, Rob. Great to chat with you. I'm looking forward to the Super Performers merch that's coming my way post this podcast. I like the name and the logo. So
yeah, you'll get the hat and the sweater vest.
Sweet. Awesome. Great to talk to you.
Yeah. Thanks, Michael. Talk soon. To learn more about or enroll in Michael Goldberg's massive open online course, Beyond Silicon Valley, Growing Entrepreneurship in Transitioning Economies, go to www.coursera.org. For a free download of the Beyond Silicon Valley book and the audiobook, or to order a print edition on Amazon, go to www.beyondsiliconvalleybook.com. All proceeds on Amazon go towards purchasing additional books to be donated to students. Thanks again for joining us on the Super Performance Podcast today, powered by 4100FS. I hope you not only enjoyed listening, but you found the insights thought-provoking and relevant. We'll be back soon with another episode of Super Performers, Insights from the Driven. This is Rob Herman. Bye for now.